This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's reading of Yankee Magazine. You'll hear stories about the people and places that make New England special. Mountains, farmland, salty seacoasts, history, sports teams, universities, cultural attractions, food, and more. This is Charlene, and I'll be reading from the March-April issue of Yankee Magazine, and this is episode 4. Thank you for joining me, and a shout out thank you to Naomi for reading episodes 1 and 2. Along with Yankee, I'll also be reading some articles from Down East Magazine if I need some extra articles. And that's another great source for fun and facts in New England. First article, Home Architecture 101, Uncurbed Appeal. How Victorian ambition and a bit of Yankee artistry took simple wood trim over the top to create New England's signature gingerbread houses. In his 1908 essay, Ornament and Crime, the Austro-Hungarian modernist architect Adolf Loos declared, "Ornament does not heighten my joy in life or the joy in life of any cultivated person." To which I and the many fans of gingerbread houses say, "Adolf, baby, loosen up." Anyone who has ever walked along a street of sober, stalwart, sensible structures and then, surprise, spotted an exuberantly decorated gingerbread cottage will know the delight that this architectural style provides. Wander through an entire neighborhood of them, namely the 34-acre, 318-house campground in Oak Bluffs, Martha's Vineyard, and you might just feel as if you've landed in some New England version of Willy Wonka's world of pure imagination. Overseen by the Martha's Vineyard Camp Meeting Association, it is the region's most enthusiastic, repudiated of puritanical plainness. It makes sense that a group of like-minded folks united in their faith and coming together each summer would feel liberated from the conventions back on the mainland, wherever they called home. They originally housed themselves in tents, but when they started to make their little campground more permanent, they kind of went wild. Wavy verge boards, looping scrollwork, elaborate turnings, dripping pendants. This was a riot of form and color that practically shouted freedom. In many ways, the campers were a microcosm of something happening in American culture at large. In the mid-19th century, the country was moving away from being an agricultural society at the far edge of Western civilization to becoming a manufacturing-based powerhouse, connected and interconnected like never before. In 1840, most travel was by coach and wagon and boat. There were 2,800 miles of railroad track. 4 decades later, there were 95,000 miles of railroad track. Handcraft gave way to machinery, propelled in part by the material demands of the Civil War. As people's movements sped up, so did fashions. New ideas flowed as quickly as new products, and the building industry was a prime mover with catalogs full of eye-catching decorations ready to be delivered to the nearest train station. People expressed their expanded horizons in 3 dimensions, building houses that broke with the past. Well, not quite. The architectural styles like Gothic Revival and Italianate softened the blow of the new by making a point of nodding to old-world models. But make no mistake, these were new ideas popping up in American cities and towns. Yet, unlike capes and center chimney colonials, gingerbread is not a purely New England type. Its origins in new forms of manufacturing and transportation, marketed and distributed far and wide, dictated that it would be, if not a national style, a nationally available one, accessible to anyone with a catalog and a sense of adventure. Virginia and Lee McAllister's classic, A Field Guide to American Houses, doesn't even list gingerbread in its chapters. It's more a question of adornment and ornament applied over a Victorian-era-based style. The more the better, though just about any building, even a Stoic Greek revival, could get a little fillip from the addition of a bit of fancy work here or there. The ease of application aided the homeowner's sense of whimsy. Aiding and abetting the adventure was the rise of machine-cut, standard-dimension lumber and the wire nails to hold it together. Before these, builders were limited by heavy timbers whose bulk necessitated simple, boxy forms. The new lightweight stick framing allowed for easier corners, curves, overhangs, bays, porches, and dormers, and every exposed edge was an opportunity for tacking on some more decoration. In some cases, especially in the variant style known as Carpenter Gothic, there was little or no theory in operation other than perhaps more is more. As Britannica describes it, turrets, spires, and pointed arches were applied, in many instances with abandon, and there was usually no logical relationship of ornamentation to the structure of the house. Certainly, the temptation was there. Illustrated catalogs from the time show page after page after page of turned work, square-turned work, sawn balusters, cornice brackets, pierced frieze boards, braced arches, scroll-sawn spandrels, pinnacles, porch roof cresting, and on it goes. Much of this cornucopia was made possible by the mid-19th century development of the scroll saw, the jigsaw, and the bandsaw, which allowed factories to turn out boxcars full of decorative woodwork. While fretwork, intricately cut patterned wood panels, had been around for centuries, these saws sped up the job exponentially. Novelty woodworks in Boston's South End became a center for such products, but the tradition of American handiwork didn't die out. Our Homes and Their Adornments, 1882, was both a catalog and something of a how-to book, encouraging its DIY-inclined readers to give it a go. Some of the higher-priced scroll sawing machines have a turning lathe attachment and are equipped with a complement of chisels and gouges by means of which many useful and ornamental articles can be easily turned, the author writes. Some also have a buzzsaw attachment, a dovetailing attachment, a molding attachment, and buffing and polishing attachments, so that they are adapted to a great variety of work. Norm Abram would be proud. In the opinion of this author, scale is important to a successful gingerbread. The houses of Martha's Vineyard's campground are smaller than some modern garages, yet more ornamented than a cathedral, and it works. The eye can take in the whole. Larger structures seem to lose focus, the finely detailed fretwork becoming diluted as it stretches out over seeming acres of facade, the sweet shapes descending into gewgaw territory in their embarrassment. That said, the elaborate wedding cake house in Kennebunk, Maine, is high, wide, and quite handsome, not to mention valuable. It recently sold for $1.825 million. Another reason to support small, upkeep is a bear. All that surface area, all those piercings and joints, the edges that hold water, the seams that open up. What we've noticed in a lot of these houses, says painting contractor Rack Iskadarian, is that we find rot because there's a lot of places for water to hide. Based in Watertown, Massachusetts, his firm has painted gingerbreads all around the Boston suburbs. We often have to have pieces fabricated to match, and the polychrome work is tough. You get into a bunch of color changing, which takes a lot of time. Some of the details get painted first, and then you have to work around them with the rest of the colors. It's a lot of brushwork. Before he died in 1933, Adolph Loos wrote, "I have emerged victorious from my 30 years of struggle. I have freed mankind from superfluous ornament." That's news to us. And every August, the Martha's Vineyard campground transforms into a magical lantern-lit scene for Grand Illumination Night, an annual tradition since 1869. Take a virtual trip to this one-of-a-kind celebration and see plenty more gingerbread cottages by queuing up Weekends with Yankees' recent visit to the campground at newengland.com/mvgingerbread. And this article was brought to us by Bruce Irving. In the kitchen, food, shelf life, 10 New England books to help launch a new chapter in your home cooking adventures by Amy Traverso. As a judge for the Readable Feast Awards, an annual salute to New England's best culinary books, I am always looking for new titles from local authors. And I can tell you right now, it's been a great year for New England cookbooks. Here are some of my favorite releases from the past 12 months, alongside a few eagerly anticipated books scheduled to hit the shelves in May. Happy reading. The Blue Food Cookbook, Delicious Seafood Recipes for a Sustainable Future, by Andrew Zimmern and Barton Seaver. Cooking seafood can be confusing. Farmed fish or wild? What about mercury? This book offers clear answers along with a useful guide to seafood species, information on what to buy, and more than 145 tempting recipes, including several chowders and stews. Note on the title, Blue Food refers to anything harvested from aquatic environments, including kelp and other sea veggies. It's $45 from HarperCollins, Harvest, October 2025. Braided Heritage, Recipes and Stories on the Origin of American Cuisine by Jessica B. Harris. Culinary historian Harris, a longtime Martha's Vineyard resident, tells the foundational story of American food by exploring the interplay among indigenous, European, and African culinary traditions, a narrative fleshed out in recipes like Huguenot tort and Wampanoag clam fritters. Rarely is the story of our nation's cooking told so prismatically. And that's $35 from Clarkson Potter, June 2025. And Dory's Anytime Cakes by Dory Greenspan. This beloved cookbook author describes anytime cakes as the cakes that can have frosting but don't need it, the cakes we pack for picnics and school lunches, the cakes that come together easily. From sheet pan carrot cakes to French spice cakes, nonettes, to the BFF brownie cake, Greenspan gives you more than 100 good reasons to get baking. And that's $35 from HarperCollins Harvest, October of 2025. An Everyday Chef, Simple Dishes for Family and Friends by Jeremy Sewell with Erin Byers-Murray. After decades in professional kitchens, Sewell found himself making daily dinners at home during the pandemic and became inspired by a whole new approach to food. Restaurant cooking and home cooking are really different. Both of them are a skill set that you develop over time, he says. His book is full of familiar comfort foods like banana bread and mac and cheese, but also offers easy ways to jazz up the daily repertoire. Try the brioche French toast with brown butter bananas. And that's $40 from Rizzoli, September 2025. In Season, 125-plus sweet and savory recipes celebrating simple, fresh ingredients by Lisa Steele. In her second cookbook, Maine egg farmer and food writer Steele makes a fresh argument for eating in season. Not only is it delicious, but it's also more economical. Recipes like three cheese tomato tarts and warm molten lemon souffle cakes make the most of what's fresh. The recipes are accessible, but sophisticated enough to feel special. And that's $34.99, Harper Celebrate, May 2026. And Jacques Pepin Complete Techniques, 50th Anniversary Edition, by Jacques Pepin. The two books that Pepin ranks among his greatest achievements, La Technique and La Méthode, are combined in this new release, making it the perfect capstone for the legendary French chef's 90th birthday celebration last year. Step-by-step photos show you how to bone a chicken, shuck an oyster, make pastry cream, 600 techniques and 1,000 images in all, plus 160 recipes you can make with all your new skills. And that's $60 from Hachette Black Dog in Leventhal, April 2026. A Kitchen on Goose Cove, Recipes from the Heart of Maine, by Devin Finnegan. At the Deer Isle Restaurant, Aragosta, guests experience Maine in its distilled form. Plates of pristine seafood, seasonal fruits, homemade pasta, and fresh vegetables served with a view of sea and islands, spruce and pine. Chef Ona Finnegan's first cookbook captures the special feel of this place with such recipes as duck breast with peach sauce, mussels chowder, whoopie pies, and her signature lobster pasta. $35, Artisan, May 2026. The Martha's Vineyard Cookbook, 100 Recipes from the Island's Restaurants, Farmers, Fishermen, and Food Artisans, by Julia Blanter. Year-round vineyard resident Blanter calls her cookbook a love letter to the island, and that love shines through in its gorgeous photos of the landscapes, people, and food that make this place unique. With a foreword by Wampanoag leader Julie Vanderhoop, owner of the Orange Peel Bakery in Akina, the book showcases 100 recipes, brown butter lobster rolls, striped bass and clam chowder, fig and honey tart, and more, from Blanter's friends and food lovers around the island as well as her own kitchen. And that's $45, Rizzoli, March 2025. And My Harvest Kitchen, 100 plus recipes to savor the seasons, by Jazine Bullock Prado. In her seventh cookbook, the celebrated pastry guru takes readers through the seasons in her Vermont kitchen, garden, and baking school. A great storyteller and a crackerjack recipe developer, Bullock Prado serves up gems like cheddar and chive biscuits, chicken leek and mushroom pie, and sour cherry pie. And that's $35 from Countrymen Press, October 2025. And New England Brunch, Seasonal Midday Meals for Leisurely Weekends, by Tammy Dunro Inman. Using brunch as her organizing principle, Inman weaves New England-y ingredients, blueberries, maple, apples, pumpkins, seafood, and cultural influences, British, Portuguese, Indigenous, Italian, to craft more than 100 sweet and savory recipes such as Boston cream donuts, Portuguese sweet rolls, and Three Sisters succotash. And that's $35, Glow Picot Press, in April of 2025. And weekend away for travel, Providence, Rhode Island. Bright culinary flavors infuse a springtime visit to Little Rhodey's capital city, by Elise Major, photos by Angel Tucker. Spring arrived for me on a late March day as I sat at a window-side table at Ellie's, a Parisian-style bakery cafe in downtown Providence. It had been a long winter even by southern New England standards, and the snowflake icon persisted on my phone's weather app like gum stuck to the sole of a shoe. And yet I had reason for hope. Sure, my coffee and shiny croissant had elevated the vibe, but through the restaurant's sky-high windows were the unmistakably verdant views of budding trees and recently potted curbside flowers. Around me, a flurry of springtime cheer filled the air as students and neighbors filed in and out of Ellie's for all manner of pick-me-ups, baguettes, croissants, and any of the decadent macarons from lemon lavender to strawberry rose champagne. A few decades ago, the central district in which Ellie sits proudly reclaimed its historical Down City nickname. The neighborhood's rebirth is emblematic of not just Providence's revival. Today, the surrounding streets are lined with a wide selection of independently owned shops like Craftland and Symposium Books, but also the city's rising acclaim as a foodie town. This growing reputation comes courtesy of plucky chefs making the most of locally produced, farmed, caught, and bottled provisions. I've been writing about the Providence food scene for years, and it's never been better. Last year, for the first time ever, four Providence chefs and restaurants made the short list for the James Beard Awards. The most notable among them was Gift Horse chef Sky Hanul Kim, who won for Best Chef Northeast. To restaurant connoisseurs who are willing to venture beyond Boston and Portland, this isn't surprising. After all, this is the sort of thing that happens when Johnson & Wales University, JWU, grads make a go of it on their home turf. Consider the immediate area surrounding Ellie's, which one could argue is the best culinary city block in all of New England. Across from the bakery is Oberlin, a popular restaurant lauded for its seafood-forward Italian dishes that was a 2025 James Beard finalist for Outstanding Restaurant. Like Kim, Chef Benjamin Sukley, a three-time James Beard finalist for Best Chef Northeast, and sommelier Bethany Cagliaro are JWU grads, and their eatery features an open kitchen, a wood-fired oven, and a steady soundtrack of soulful tunes. There's ample seating at both the bar and dining room, with an interior just sophisticated enough to feel special without requiring you to dress up. The main menu at Oberlin is stuffed with dishes like whole wood roasted fish and hearty pastas. But if the weather is right, time you visit between 3 and 5 p.m. for chiacchetti on the patio, for raw bar oysters and clams, as well as a perky drinks menu showcasing rhodium vodka distilled in the neighboring city of Pawtucket. Next door, you'll find Oberlin's sister restaurant, Gift Horse, a delight for anyone who enjoys an unexpected mix of flavors that are always beautifully plated. Beyond its full-service raw bar, the full menu's lineup of unexpected delights, smoked scalloped rolls, and crispy piri-piri fish, to name a few, has earned the restaurant accolades, including a nod from the New York Times as one of its top 50 restaurants in America in 2024. And while Chef Sky Hanul Kim recently returned to South Korea to be closer to family, internal promotions have kept the kitchen from missing a beat. Just steps away is Celito Mexican Kitchen, dishing Machiokan takes on Mexican classics. I'm a big fan of the chiles anchos rellenos made with dried raisins, which lend a sweet chewiness to the ground beef. Celito's teal-hued walls, framed flower market prints, and a luscious gladiola and marigold mural over the bar bring a welcome jolt of color to an early spring day. A new addition to the downtown dining scene is Claudine. Opened last June, it's the vision of husband and wife team Josh Finger and Maggie McConnell, who met while working at Thomas Keller's famed Pear Serre in New York City. By design, the only views at Claudine are of the elegantly plated dishes in the open kitchen, where you can witness the owners practice the art of precision. I love the restaurant's parade of polished French-inspired cuisine showcasing regional ingredients like confit de boat scallops. Just be sure not to rush your experience at Claudine's. Dining here may very well be your activity for the night, and that's fine. For accommodations, the Beatrice pairs nicely with Providence's food scene. The stylish boutique hotel's financial district location puts you smack dab in the center of nightlife. It's just a short walk to Providence Performing Arts Center, a historic gem of a theater with a roster of nationally touring musicals and a rare Mighty Wurlitzer pipe organ, still played by housed organist Peter Edwin Krasinski. Seemingly transplanted directly from Europe, the Beatrice boasts such high-end amenities as heated towel racks and heated bidets and a rooftop bar perfect for spring's early sunsets. It's also home to Bellini Providence, a posh eatery outfitted in blush antique whose name is derived from the Venetian cocktail of fresh peach puree and Prosecco. Dining here offers up a nice excuse to dress up for lunch, dinner, or weekend brunch. Finally, any spring weekend must include a trek to Roger Williams Park. Free and open daily from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., the Landscape Historic District, named for the state's founder, is owned by the city and covers 435 acres with 100 acres of lakes. While it's getting trickier to forecast bloom time, mid-April through early May generally means the park's Japanese garden is awash in a palette of pinks provided by flowering trees, including cherry blossoms. There are walking trails, too, plus a self-guided tour of art and architecture, which no doubt will help you work up an appetite for your next delicious bite. Exploring Providence, Rhode Island. Eat. Brown Bee Coffee. Tear into handmade croissants over artisan quality coffee in a cafe brimming with academic types in the College Hill neighborhood between Brown University and RISD. Frank and Laurie's. When Chef Eric Brown and his wife Sarah Watts moved to Providence, they couldn't find a good place for lunch, so they opened one. While billed mostly as a luncheonette, it's not quite like places your Nana might have taken you for a turkey sandwich. It's very pretty inside, and the biscuits are scrumptious. Nick's on Broadway. With its menu showcasing local produce, Chef Derek Wagner's creation has been a West End go-to since 2002. Look for spring dishes emphasizing bright greens such as parsley, pea greens, and spinach. Pizza Marvin. Founded by Chef Robert Andreozzi, Pizza Marvin is a lively place on eclectic Wickenden Street for a pie, a slice, or surprising offerings like clam dip with potato chips. Or Track 15. What was once a train station has been transformed into an 18,000-square-foot food hall where you can dig into fare from 7 buzzy local restaurants plus beverages including tasty mocktails from the central bar. And places to stay. Aloft Providence Downtown. What happens when JWU hospitality alums are at the helm of a Marriott-owned hotel? You get amenities and Bonvoy points, plus a property committed to showing off the city's attributes. Suites are named in honor of Providence's jewelry capital past, and you'll discover local art at every turn. The Beatrice. This luxury 47-room hotel consistently tops national lists, and for good reason. Rooms are oh-so-comfy with 600-thread-count linens and plush matouk towels. Between the Dyson hairdryer and the heated toilet, you may never leave the bathroom. Shop and Play. Downtown Makers Marketplace. This pantry, cafe, and beverage bar showcases offerings from Hope in Maine, a food business incubator in the nearby coastal town of Warren. Fire and Ice Experience at Gather. Make yourself a memento or a tasty treat or both with this studio and adjacent cafes, glass blowing, and ice cream making classes. This unexpected combo is the kind of thinking that makes PVD so wonderfully quirky. The Greenway. run by the Woonasquatucket River Watershed Council, this mural-lined bike path connects to the Providence Riverwalk. Echo tourists will love its volunteer ops like counting river herring as they return to spawn, typically beginning in early March. And the Providence Artisans Market. Lippitt Memorial Park on the east side is the place to be on Saturday mornings. Peruse produce and goods at this longtime event run by fine artist Mike Bryce, known for his paintings of Adele's lemonade cup. And Providence Culinary Collective. Spring sees the return of this buzzy culinary festival, March 26th to the 29th, which includes the Rhode Island Wine Experience. Highlights include expert panels, chef appearances, and exclusive tastings. And lastly, stock culinary goods. Any city worth its weight in sea salt should have a kitchen store as good as this one. Find serveware, cookware, gifts, and groceries, many with Rhode Island origins. And plan your path to a perfect stay in Massachusetts. The Massachusetts landscape is surprisingly varied. Rugged mountains, winding rivers, and breezy coastlines all offer welcome diversity and outdoor enjoyment. Hoping for a heart-pumping bike hike? Take your pick. More in the mood for a gentle walk by the ocean? There are plenty of those, too. If you'd rather pedal, paddle, or ski, the state is teeming with even more options to strike your fancy. The only problem won't be finding a place to hit the trails, but deciding which one to enjoy. So for hiking trails, a long drive isn't necessary to get the elevation gain you're after. You can climb a whopping 1,832 feet right in Ashburnham. At the southern end of the Wapak Range, Mount Wetaddock rewards you with views of the Green Mountains in Vermont and the peaks of southern New Hampshire. In Holyoke, there's Mount Tom, a fairly steep hike with a high likelihood of migrating hawk sightings. At the top, the rolling hills of the Pioneer Valley unfold before you. Boston hikers are loyal to their beloved Blue Hills Reservation. There, the Skyline Trail leads to the top of Great Blue Hill. The 3.5-mile trek requires some climbing to reach the summit. Once you do, you can opt for another climb up Elliott Tower, which frames views of the city skyline. Head to the Berkshires for a challenging journey all the way up Monument Mountain. Prepare to get a bird's-eye view of the Housatonic River Valley. Or if you'd prefer coastal trails. If a stroll through salt air is more your speed, the Bay State has many trails that live up to its nickname. Bird watchers will delight in the paths crisscrossing Parker River National Wildlife Refuge in Newbury. You'll spend most of your visit on Plum Island, with the ocean on one side of you and salt marshes on the other. World's End highlights a similarly immersive experience as you trace your drumlins jutting out into Hingham Bay, seemingly surrounded by deep blue waters. Along the hook-shaped arm of Cape Cod, the Great Island Trail in Wellfleet puts Massachusetts' coastal beauty on dazzling display. You have the option to complete an almost 9-mile loop along the beach and through pine-pitched forests, punctuated by plenty of scenic overlooks. The iconic scenery continues at Mattapoisett's Nascatucket Bay State Reservation, where you'll get a front-row seat to eelgrass meadows, coastal forest, salt marshes, and shellfish beds during your tranquil walk. If you'd rather be on the water, the only thing better than a leisurely paddle down the river is a paddle with a history lesson mixed in. If you bring your kayak or canoe to the Blackstone River in Millville, you can stop by the Millville Lock, one of the best-preserved locks from the former Blackstone Canal. There's also a visitor center in nearby Worcester, spotlighting the area's heritage. The Ipswich River, meanwhile, flows 45 miles from Burlington to Ipswich. Paddling here is mostly flat and relatively free from development. That's not the case for the Charles River, where you can put your boat in at the water at the DCR's public launch along Nonatum Road in Brighton. Paddle towards Boston to see the boathouses for numerous colleges and universities, or head inland to follow joggers along the Charles River Greenway. At Royalston, the Tully River offers another compelling kayaking experience, passing verdant wetlands on the way to Tully Lake, where there are isles and inlets to explore. Rail trails. The Commonwealth's bevy of bygone railroads has resulted in lots of opportunities for biking, in the form of rail trails, that is. And with the DCR's Universal Access Program, cyclists of all abilities can join in thanks to staff-supported adaptive cycling programs. Consider taking a ride down the Bruce Freeman Rail Trail, which stretches 20 miles from Lowell to Sudbury along the old New Haven Railroad. There's also the Kitchewick Rail Trail nearby, connecting Framingham to Natick via a paved, leafy path. Some of the state's best biking can be enjoyed on the Cape Cod Rail Trail, which winds through salt marshes, inlets, beaches, and forests from Yarmouth to Wellfleet. There are also several bike rental opportunities along the trail, like Barb's Bike Shop in South Dennis and Orleans Cycle in Orleans. In Western Mass, the Ashuwiltecook Rail Trail links Pittsfield to Adams, passing the Cheshire Reservoir and Hoosick River along the old Pittsfield and North Adams Railroad. And there's still some winter skiing, so winter may be the prime time for skiing in Massachusetts, but spring skiing shouldn't be overlooked, as nearly a dozen mountains are open until mid to late March. Start making plans to glide down the slopes at Berkshire East Mountain Resort in Charlemont, the world's first ski area powered entirely by on-site renewable energy, or carve up dozens of trails at Wachusett Mountain Ski Area, complete with a base lodge with lots of restaurants, plus a hot cider house and a waffle cabin. And now we jump into Down East magazine and an article from their North by East. Taking the plunge at an Edgecombe oyster farm, winter diving is worth the leap. At dawn on a clear morning last March, oyster farmer Ryan McPherson maneuvered a skiff across the frigid Damariscotta River. On board were a pile of large mesh bags attached to ropes and an industrial arts teacher, Andrew Jonas, who moonlights as a scuba diver. During the summer months, McPherson, who owns Edgecombe's Glidden Point Oyster Farms, and his crew use a mechanical dredge to harvest oysters from the river bottom. But at this time of year, when inventory thins, he relies on a method that's become rather rare in today's aquatic culture world, plucking the mollusks from their mucky beds by hand. It's a pain, McPherson admitted. You need to find a diver, and you need to pay him a lot. He joked that any business consultant would look at Glidden's diving operation and ask, why do that? But he believes the practice is essential primarily because dredging can damage the oyster shell. In winter, when the mollusks are dormant and can't repair themselves, even a small chip can result in death. We avoid that at all costs, McPherson said. Diving in cold water, when the water tends to be the clearest, allows the company to monitor the health of its oyster beds, which are spread across three sites totaling about 30 acres, and minimize the impacts of dredging. If you constantly hammer the river bottom with the drag, it'll change the sediment, the mixture of thick mud and sand that supports oysters while they grow, McPherson said. We've got to make sure that sediment stays the same composition forever. McPherson also happens to enjoy hanging out with commercial divers. They're their own breed, he said, noting that some divers get grumpy when they're off the meat, referring to areas where the crop is thin. Sometimes you gotta jack 'em up a little to keep up morale. Jonas, who honed his diving skills working for a program that retrieves lost fishing gear, has been harvesting oysters for McPherson on and off for 3 years. "I like to be able to just shove them in," he said, mimicking a crab with grasping claws. "Just put the bag between my legs and go to town." Once the mud kicks up, he sometimes works with his eyes closed, harvesting the feet by feel in a near meditative state. One of the state's first oyster farms, Glidden Point, was started by marine scientist Barbara Scully in 1987 as a diving-only operation. Scully harvested many of Glidden's oysters herself, and they became coveted for their firm texture and briny sweet flavor, the result of growing slowly over a period of about 3 years in chilly waters. When McPherson purchased the business in 2016, after working in the fishing and aquaculture industries in Massachusetts, demand for Maine oysters was surging, and he invested in a dredge to increase the company's production capacity. "We've tried to keep things old school while still meeting the demands of the market," he said. Last winter, Jonas put on a brave face as he prepared to back roll into the near-freezing Damariscotta. "I'm usually good body-wise," he insisted as he wrestled into his dry suit and strapped on an oxygen tank. "It's the hands that get really cold." Ledgy areas on the river bottom act as a natural tumbler, toughing up oysters' shell and shredding divers' gloves. When they were on the meat, Jonas went overboard with a mesh bag clipped to a rope with a buoy at one end. A few minutes later, McPherson clipped an empty bag to that rope, and he could pull it down when the first bag was full. After filling several bags, Jonas surfaced and helped McPherson haul them into the boat. McPherson sifted through the oysters, which were roughly 3 inches in diameter, and declared the size of the crop looked good. "As for the glassy-eyed diver, sometimes I get a bit loopy after I come up," he said, through swollen purple lips. McPherson laughed. "Maybe we should put an asterisk next to whatever comes out of his mouth next." And that article was by Jade Coffin. Another article from the North by East. It's "An Island Unto Itself." Alone, but not at sea, on an offshore compound. Last summer, Scott Kern welcomed a pair of visitors to Sand Island in Casco Bay for a 10 out of 10 five-star VIP tour. It began in a vine-covered hut he constructed from salvaged lumber collected on the mainland and calls the Garden Shed Tree Fort. On the way out, he pointed to a ladder leaning against an exterior wall. "Spoiler," he exclaimed, "the triple platinum extra pass includes a rooftop view." After taking in the island-studded bay from our modest perch, we followed a path through thick vegetation. "Keep your hands inside the ride at all times. There's poison ivy everywhere," Kern said. Past a milkweed patch dubbed Monarch Mansion to the Winch Tower Religious Thing, a shupa-like structure composed of lumber and driftwood and bedecked with buoys. It's meant to someday be hooked up to a winch Kern can use to haul his aluminum skiff onto the sand. The path ends at a driftwood pile, and we walked along a ledgy beach back to our starting point, where Kern presented his pièce de résistance, a roughly 70-foot-long curving retaining wall he hopes will prevent the sea from swallowing his compound. Kern began assembling the Great Wall of Planet Sand 2 years ago after other attempts at erecting barriers to combat erosion failed. In the last few years, he estimates, the ocean has encroached by as much as 20 feet in some spots. He has spent countless hours pulling large rocks out of the water, an effort he believes helps lower the local sea level, lugging them across the beach in a dolly and adding them to the wall. He would like to extend the barrier around the entire acre-and-a-half island, a seemingly Sisyphean task he admits he will likely never complete. "I have to try, though, because I have to save Planet Sand," he said, using his name for the island, which he says feels like another world. Kern's parents bought the uninhabited squiggle of land sandwiched between Chibig and Cliff Islands with another couple in the early 90s. The family lived on nearby Cousins Island in Yarmouth and would sail to Sand Island for day trips or to camp. They let other boaters use it, too. When he was about 18, though, Kern became addicted to drugs and alcohol and nearly forgot about the place. For more than two decades, he cycled in and out of rehab and spent periods hitchhiking across the country and living on the street. Eventually, he returned to Maine and began camping on the island. I'd wake up at noon, so hungover, and see families playing on the beach and think, what am I doing with myself? Kern said. In 2018, he got sober and started spending summers preserving Sand Island and making it welcoming for visitors, work he says has been essential to his recovery. The week we visited, Kern had given his VIP tour to kids and counselors from a sailing school who camped out overnight and the crew of a 112-foot yacht who were out for a joyride. "People ask me, what's your typical day?" said Kern, who owns a property management business in Saco. "Well, I could be alone for 3 days, or I could have a bunch of billionaires show up. When he's not entertaining, he works on the retaining wall, rakes the beach, clears paths, removes invasive plants, reinforces his structures, and collects driftwood in the water and on the shore for future building projects. A deep freezer powered by a gas generator minimizes trips to the mainland for food, which he mostly grills, and a rusty wood stove perched in the sand in his primitive kitchen keeps things toasty enough. I never felt like I fit in anywhere, but out here I'm so comfortable," Kern said. "All winter, it's like I can't wait to go move rocks on planet sand." And that article is by Sarah Stebbins. And another North by East story. Storyland. An exhibit sketches out the career of a beloved children's book author. More than 30 years ago, Camden illustrator Chris Van Dusen had the idea to draw a boat ensnared in a tree. The image inspired his first children's book, Down to the Sea with Mr. McGee, about a man whose skiff rides a fountain of spray from a whale's blowhole to the top of a spruce. McGee is a thought line in Van Dusen's work, serving as the titular protagonist, or a Where's Waldo character in his 11 books. And he's a through line in Up That Isle in Maine at the Maine Maritime Museum, which explores Van Dusen's career through four of his classic tales. Visitors can peruse early sketches, read in a replica of McGee's boat beneath a sculpture of Hudson, the friendly lake monster, climb aboard a recreation of the steamboat from the circus ship, and hunt for McGee in a mural of the book's island village on the opposite wall. Again, that article's by Sarah Stebbins. Splendor in the Grass. A salt marsh provides a Yarmouth painter with endless inspiration and art supplies. On a single-digit December morning, Mitchell Razor trudged through the woods in Yarmouth's Spear Farm Estuary Preserve toward his usual plein air perch. Emerging in a salt marsh that borders the Royal River, he pulled a roll of heavy white paper from his backpack and unfurled it on the snow. Next to it, he nestled a plastic palette, tubes of tar black watercolor paint, and a tin camp cup to fill with salt water. Then he went hunting for paintbrushes among the tall, fragmites reeds fringing the marsh's frozen channels. Razor clawed at the paper with a rusty nail, cutting a crude intaglio of a copse of reeds and furrowed land. He swirled the feathery head of one of the fragmites in water and paint and filled in the gouges. Little pools of liquid froze, leaving behind crystallized impressions. Over the next few days, Razor would return to the marsh to add more scratches and paint. He'd score the paper with whatever he finds, a twig, the point of an acorn, brittle cordgrass, driftwood sharpened with his pocket knife. He might submerge the painting in the river and watch the black run in sinewy cataracts, marsh grass shards, or phragmite seeds into it, or burn driftwood and use a rock to grind the charcoal into a pigment that, when mixed with water, forms a coarse slurry he can smear across the surface. If the water in his cup freezes, he'll dilute the paint with hot tea from his thermos, staining the paper yellow. A landscape architect and musician, Razor began painting the Spear Farm Marsh as an artist-in-residence with the Royal River Conservation Trust in 2023. He has since created hundreds of watercolors that document the area's changing environment using the very elements that make up the place. It's a way of recording without pretense, he says, of staying open to and engaged with what's happening at the site that day. The resulting impressionistic works, with their shadowy, haunting shades, resemble Rorschach test or blurry black and white photographs. Razor, who played bass in the 80s post-punk band Absolute Grey, calls them punk rock water lilies. I come out of that end of the spectrum in music of trying to relentlessly experiment, he says. Here, you get these incredible variables to balance and negotiate. If it's particularly cold, sometimes the paintings will look heavy, with a buildup of material on them. If it's a bit warmer, they might have more of a wash and be more nuanced. Razor paints for an hour or two most winter mornings and says he rarely gets cold. The New England landscape in winter is astounding in the way you can see through it, he says. You can see the geology, the layering of things. When the leaves come out, I actually get depressed because everything's blocked. On the morning of our visit, we reach the marsh in time to catch the sunrise lighting up the church steeple next to his house on the other side of the river. Dressed in an unzipped Carhartt jacket, jeans, and muck boots, Razor battled a stiff breeze that lifted the edge of the paper he was painting, sent another sheet skidding toward the reeds, and flipped his palette, spraying his clothes with paint. A few days earlier, the wind had carried off an unfinished work. As we headed back through the woods, he stopped suddenly. "Oh, here's my painting," he cried, picking up a hazy seascape streaked with yellow. A phragmite's frond had frozen to one corner. "I liked the start of this one," he said, tucking the work under his arm. "Sorry, where was I?" And that article is by Sarah Ann Donnelly, and the Portland Museum of Art will host a screening of Salt Marsh, a documentary about Razor's work, followed by an artist talk on March 29th at 4 p.m. That's at 7 Congress Square in Portland. And North by East, Maine Dispatches. Facing the fire. A 3-alarm fire at Portland's historic Custom House Wharf destroyed 4 businesses, gutted workshops used by local fishermen, and damaged fishing boats. No members of the public were hurt, though some firefighters sustained minor injuries. The blaze appears to have started in a workshop, then spread to a boat repair shop, Nanook Kayaks, Maritime Antiques, and the Sea Bags Factory store. There is no evidence of foul play. More than 100 firefighters from Portland and surrounding areas contained the blaze in less than 2 hours, in part by cutting a hole in the roof of the antique shop, which allowed the flames to escape rather than spread through the building. The Brunswick-based Maine Coast Fishermen's Association raised $200,000 to support impacted fishermen, some of whom lost a lifetime's worth of gear. "We've seen groups of people trying to help out the fishermen, trying to help out the businesses that have lost things," Portland Fire Chief Chad Johnson told the Portland Herald Press. "It wasn't just our piece of the puzzle here." And fishy business. The Maine Indian Tribal State Commission released an audiobook that explores how state policies have depleted traditional fisheries and limited Wabanaki people's access to them. Sea Run brings to life a 2022 report by the commission, with Wabanaki citizens recounting how dams, overfishing, and pollution have decimated salmon, shad, and alewife populations, and recommending solutions that include supporting traditional Wabanaki hunting practices. It seems like if restoration of the fish is of the highest priority, why isn't restoration of the Wabanaki culture put on a similar priority level for the state of Maine? Co-author Judd Etsy Kendall asked Maine Public. In Whale of a Time, wildlife educator Jessica Woodend has been making a splash at Maine libraries and schools with a life-size inflatable humpback whale. Since launching her business, Within the Whale, a little over a year ago, Woodend has traveled to nearly 90 spots around the state to give presentations with her 43-foot-long sidekick, Chunk. Participants can step inside the whale's cavernous body and explore its anatomy while also learning about the mammal's habitat and behaviors, environmental threats, and more. Chunk is named after a female humpback whale with a nicked dorsal fin who died in 2024 after becoming entangled in fishing gear off Cape Elizabeth. Her inflatable counterpart features an identical forked dorsal fin. I knew people were excited and curious about these animals, and not everyone can go out and find whales, Woodend told News Center Maine. I decided to try to bring the whale to them. This reading of Yankee Magazine and Down East Magazine has been a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Charlene, and thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. This robin is making a delivery of tasty caterpillars to its fledglings. Like many songbirds, they rely on these insects to raise their young, says entomologist Douglas Tallamy.
It takes thousands and thousands and thousands of caterpillars to make one clutch of baby birds. And that's just to get it to the point where it fledges, where it leaves the nest.
But habitat loss is making caterpillars and other nutritious insects hard to come by. So Tallamy co-founded an organization called Homegrown National Park to help people bring biodiversity to their own gardens, which can be as easy as planting an acorn.
Oaks support more species of caterpillars than any other tree genus in the country.
Hundreds of butterfly and moth species start their lives as caterpillars foraging in oak branches, making these trees a fully stocked pantry for birds like tanagers, bluebirds,
titmice, chickadees, cardinals, red-bellied woodpeckers, downy woodpeckers, pileated woodpeckers, magnolia warblers, hooded warblers, prairie warblers, yellow warblers, wood thrushes, and hermit thrushes.
The list goes on.
So when you plant an oak, you're actually planting an entire community. You're creating an awful lot of life in your yard that wasn't there before you put that oak in. That life is called biodiversity.
To learn more about Homegrown National Park and how to take part in their simple grassroots solution to the biodiversity crisis, visit birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
Now here's a puzzler. Before Mount Everest was discovered, what was the highest mountain on Earth?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
Mount Everest was the highest mountain on Earth, even before it was discovered.
And now back to our regular programming.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, Hey, Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn.